Leviticus chapter 25 tonight. Leviticus 25. It's quite a long chapter. And it's a very important chapter as well, as far as the way that the scriptures work out. I think a lot of people would agree that probably of there are two chapters in Leviticus. This is not a book people read a great deal, as you know. But when they do, these two chapters are the ones they tend to focus on. There's chapter 19, the Day of Atonement. There's chapter 25, which is the year of Jubilee. That's the passage we're going to be reading. Chapter 25 of the book of Leviticus on the subject of the year of Jubilee. But there's other things in here as well. I'm just going to say what in one of the commentaries it said about this chapter. It said, this has probably been the most influential chapter in Leviticus through its concern for economic and social justice, its influence on prophecy of the end times and on Jesus, its use by certain strands in Christian social ethics. It's a complex chapter in which three distinct economic practices are thrown closely together, along with parenthetical sections and exceptive clauses. So this is a dense portion of scripture. That's what I'm preparing you for. It's a dense portion of scripture, and what I'm going to be able to say from it is only going to be touching on some of the substance that's there, and I may pick it up again. But let's read it together, shall we? Beginning in verse 1, chapter 25, verse 1, page 90. The Lord said to Moses on Mount Sinai, "Speak to the Israelites. Say to them, when you enter the land I'm going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. For 6 years sow your fields, for 6 years prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a Sabbath of rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields, prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the grapes of your untended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. And whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food to you, for yourself, for your manservant, your maidservant, and your hired worker, temporary residents, those who live amongst you, as well as for your livestock and the wild animals in your land. Whatever the land produces may be eaten. Now count off 7 Sabbaths of years, 7 times 7 years, so that the 7 Sabbaths of years amount to a period of 49 years. And then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. Sound the trumpet throughout your land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each one of you is to return to his family property and each to his own clan. The 50th year shall be a jubilee for you. Do not sow, do not reap what grows of itself or harvest the untended vines. It's a jubilee and it's to be holy for you. Eat only what is taken directly from the fields. In this year of jubilee, everyone is to return to his own property. If you sell land to one of your countrymen or buy land any from him, do not take advantage of each other. You are to buy from your countrymen on the basis of a number of years since the Jubilee, and he is to sell to you on the basis of the number of years left for harvesting crops. When the years are many, you are to increase the price. And when the years are few, you are to decrease the price because what he is really selling you is the number of crops. Do not take advantage of each other, but fear your God. I am the Lord your God. Follow my decrees and be careful to obey my laws, and you will live safely in the land. And then the land will yield its fruit, and you will eat your fill and live there in safety. And you may ask, what will we eat in the seventh year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? I will send you such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. And while you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it till the harvest of the ninth year comes. The land must not be sold permanently, because the land is mine, and you are but aliens and my tenants. Throughout the country that you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. If one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells some of his property, his nearest relative is to come and redeem what his countryman has sold. If, however, a man has no one to redeem it for him, but he himself prospers and requires sufficient means to redeem it, he is to determine the value for the years since he sold it and refund the balance to the man to whom he sold it. He can go back then to his own property. But if he does not acquire the means to repay him, what he sold will remain in the possession of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. It will be returned in the Jubilee, and he can then go back to his property. If a man sells a house in a walled city, he retains the right of redemption a full year after the sale, and during that time he may redeem it. But if he does not redeem it before a full year has passed, the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to the buyer and to his descendants. It's not to be returned in the Jubilee. But houses in villages, without walls around them, are to be considered open country. They can be redeemed, and they are to be returned in the Jubilee. The Levites always have the right to redeem their houses in the Levitical towns which they possess, so the property of the Levites is redeemable. That is, a house sold in any town they hold, and it is to be returned in the Jubilee, because the houses in the towns of the Levites are their property amongst the Israelites. But the pasture land belonging to their towns must not be sold. It is their permanent possession. If one of your countrymen becomes poor, he's unable to support himself amongst you, help him as you would an alien or a temporary resident, so that he can continue to live amongst you. And do not take interest of any kind from him, but fear your God, so that your countrymen may continue to live amongst you. You must not lend him money at interest or sell him food for a profit. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. If one of your countrymen becomes poor amongst you and sells himself to you, do not make him work as a slave. He is to be treated as a hired worker or a temporary resident amongst you. He is to work for you until the year of Jubilee. And then he and his children are to be released, and he'll go back to his own clan, to the property of his forefathers. Because the Israelites are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt, and they must not be sold as slaves. Do not rule over them ruthlessly, but fear your God. Your male and female slaves are to come from the nations around you. From them you may buy slaves. You may also buy some of the temporary residents living among you and members of their clans born in your country, and they will become your property. You can will them to your children as inherited property and can make them slaves for life, but you must not rule over your fellow Israelites ruthlessly. If an alien or a temporary resident amongst you becomes rich, and one of your countrymen becomes poor and sells himself to the alien living amongst you, or to a member of an alien's clan, he retains the right of redemption after he has sold himself. One of his relatives may redeem him. An uncle or a cousin or a blood relative in his clan may redeem him. Or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. He and his buyer are to count the time from the year he sold himself to the year of Jubilee. The price for his release is to be based on the rate paid of a hired man for that number of years. If many years remain, he may pay for his redemption a larger share of the price paid for him. If only a few years remain until the year of Jubilee, he is to compute that and pay for his redemption accordingly. He is to be treated as a man hired from year to year. You must see to it that the owner does not rule over him ruthlessly. And even if he does not redeem in any of these ways, he and his children are to be released for the year of Jubilee. For the Israelites belong to me as servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Should we pray? It is a pretty substantial chapter. There are different things in here. There's a whole theme about slavery, isn't there? I think I might leave that in part, at least, for another time, because it's very complicated, I think. But you've got the basic outline, the Sabbath year. That's the first thing, isn't it? 1 year in six. You're not going to work the fields. You're not going to do any work for a whole year. That's quite a thought, isn't it? Every 6 years, you work, and then you have a holiday for a whole year. Some of us have difficulties taking a day off, right? A whole year. It's quite remarkable, isn't it? Very searching. And then there's this subject of the Jubilee. All the debts that have been accumulated. Not just like over a few weeks or months, but over 50 years. All the books are cancelled. All the debts are cancelled. That's quite amazing, isn't it? Sort of the leveling of all the accounts once every 50 years, twice every century. That's probably once in everybody's lifetime, isn't it? Pretty much, in the ordinary life. You probably have one opportunity where you just go back to the beginning again. You'd start all over again with the initial thing that God gave you when you first entered the land, a plot of land, a little bit of earth in the place where he has given you. Just that's what his gift to you. And you can go back to the zero and you could start all over again. And nobody's ever going to fall through the net. Nobody's ever going to be able to slip so far and go so low that they lose that basic gift that God has given. That should make us think about grace at least, shouldn't it, in our relationship with God, you know, that somehow there's a bedrock that is ours in Christ, something that he will always guarantee to us and look after and protect. And it's wonderful to think about. There's a lot to think about in it. And then from verse 23 to 55, there's various applications, aren't there, to the general kind of process of redemption, this great theme, redemption. We talk about redemption a lot. You sing about it in our hymns. It comes up from time to time. This is where the word redemption originates. This is where we first hear about redemption in this chapter. You can understand why it's so important. This whole idea of having a redeemer, somebody who'll stand up for you, somebody who'll pay the price for you. You can understand why this is an important chapter, can't you? This is the beginning, a whole idea that somebody, you might not have a relative, you might not have somebody, but there's somebody who'd be prepared to pay the price so that you could go free. I mean, you can understand why this is an important chapter, can't you? Now, I'm not going to be able to plumb out all these depths by any means, but I think the Jubilee is the main one, isn't it? Jubilee is the main subject that draws people's attention. It is such a... people do surveys of the ancient world and the laws that the ancient peoples created and formed for themselves by the inspiration of their gods. And there isn't anything or anyone anywhere in the world who had a law like this that guaranteed a fundamental gift to all the people that whatever happened in your life, your successes, your failures, he was never going to let you go. Your land was your land. It's God's gift to you, and it would be yours by guarantee. That would never leave you. Your place, you had a place in his world. It's quite remarkable. It stands out. And it means that there was always hope, wasn't it? Always hope. Okay, you might have to work for 50 years. You might have 50 tough years. But there was always hope that one day you would go home. You know, how far you drifted, one day you would come home. That's quite an amazing thought. Coming home is a really powerful theme, isn't it? The idea of home. This is just by the by, but in Greece, a group of people arrived in Greece. And these people had come from what is the Ukraine. And there was about 800 or 900 of them arrived on an aeroplane. And they said, "We've come home." And they were all Ukrainian citizens. And they said, "We are Greeks." And it turns out that in the time of the Athenian Republic in the 5th century BC, embassies were sent from the Athenian Republic to go and start little colonies all around the Black Sea, trading outposts of the Athenian Empire that would bring grain and other supplies back to Greece. And in all the course of history, what happened is these people got separated off from the main body of the Greek-speaking world and got integrated into the Russian world and all the rest of it. And after 2,500 years, these people still thought of themselves and saw themselves as Greeks. And after a while, they decided, "I think it's time to go home." And they turned up in Greece and claimed to be Greek citizens. In fact, they said, "We are more Greek than you are." Because consequent to what happened in Greece, they'd been overrun by the Turks and all the rest of it. They'd changed. They said, "We're more Greek than you. We're the real Greeks. Move over." It's amazing, the whole thing about going home. people, obviously one of the big, great, great examples of that is the return of millions of Jewish people to the land, which is Israel, the state of Israel today, coming around for after 2,000 years of exile, a language that would basically be dead, and people scattered through the world have all returned home. This whole idea that there's a place for you, there's a place for you, and that somehow, some way, you're going to get home. Do you want to go home? Do you know where your home is? Have you got a guaranteed place? Have you got your citizenship papers? Do you know where you belong? Do you know you're going to get there? Such an important theme, isn't it? It speaks so deeply into the human psyche and into the way that we're made, to have this hope. Because truth be told, peoples go through all sorts of things in this world, don't we? We go through all sorts of things. Families go through changing fortunes. Some of it is circumstantial. Some of it's of our own making. Good things happen, fortunes are made, fortunes are lost, accidents happen, all the vagaries of life, these things happen, don't they? And people can end up in seasons like some of the people we read about here, poor and oppressed, struggling in this world. But these laws talk about those people in those times and those papers having a guarantee, a fundamental guarantee of rights. You know, if you've got a bit of land, if you've got a bit of land, you've got something, haven't you? You can plant a carrot. You're not going to starve. If you've got a bit of land, there's something you can make for yourself. You can make a life for yourself if you've just got a bit of land. And this guarantee to everybody, a bit of land, a bit of the land of promise, a bit of that land of milk and honey that you could work with your hands. And whatever happens, somehow you, your children, your children's children, somehow that's going to be, God was going to make sure that was always going to be yours. Can you think in the whole of the Old Testament? I know you spend a lot of time reading your Old Testament. Can you think as you read your Old Testament of a single example of the year of Jubilee being enacted? A time where one of the kings or one of the prophets said, now the 50th year has come. Let all the people return to their lands and everything like that. I can't. There is no record in anywhere in the Old Testament that this glorious, sublime law that could only have come from the gracious hand of our mighty God was ever actually put into practice. Now, I'm not saying it was never practiced. I'm just saying it was never recorded as having practice. Interestingly, the Day of Atonement, there is no record in the Old Testament that the Day of Atonement was ever put into practice. I'm not saying it didn't happen. I'm just saying there is no record of it. So we can't read too much into it. But it's just interesting, this question about how far people were prepared to go ultimately in doing things God's way. Because I think God's way and our ways are very different. Things God wants for us and the things we want for ourselves and what other people would have us in this world are quite different, and oftentimes they come into opposition one with another. It's interesting that this day of Jubilee begins at the Day of Atonement, doesn't it? It says, here you are, you sinners. All this nation has sinned and fallen short of God's standards and glory. You're all sinned. You've all fallen short of His glory. You all need forgiveness. You all need cleansing. And only on the back of having been forgiven, then now you forgive the debts of others. That sounds like somebody's prayer, doesn't it? You know? Forgive us our debts as we forgive those who are debted against us. Having received atonement, now the practical outworking of that atonement is not just verbally forgiving other people, but actually saying, do you know, the money you owe me, Andy, forget it. Just go home. Just go home. You've worked 30 years. It's time you just went home. Go home to your family. Go home to your property. Go home to your land. Okay, it's over, right? God's been good to me. Go and enjoy His blessing. You know, this is a practical thing, isn't it? But it's interesting, there's no record of people ever having done it. I'm not saying it didn't happen. But I think it would be a wonderful thing to read about. It'd be a wonderful day if it ever did happen, wouldn't it? It seems, however, that there'd be some issue about it, as if somehow maybe there was an issue, because when Jesus comes into this world, he goes to Nazareth, and his first sermon at Nazareth, he takes the text from Isaiah 61, doesn't he? And if you're familiar with Isaiah 61, he says, "Proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. Set the captives free," doesn't he? "The forgiveness of debts, the release of the prisoners." It's as if somehow the day of Jubilee has never really truly been ever practiced or used. That it's been there on the statute books as a guarantee for the poor, as a guarantee for the oppressed. But for hundreds of years, in some way, it's always been stymied and bogged down by the hands of the people in whom these things were trusted. That even if you put the perfect law in the hands of imperfect people, you will never see it being practiced perfectly. And then Jesus comes and says, "This is the acceptable year of the Lord," as if somehow he himself, in his appearing, the day of Jubilee, for the very first time in all human history, it seems that perhaps now it is occurring. You can read about it in Luke chapter 4, 16 to 30. And it's certainly true that the Sabbath year, the first seven verses of chapter 25, the Sabbath year, has been an issue for Israel. Here's a great law. The land needs a rest. Do you ever need a break? Do you ever need a rest? The land needs a rest. Anybody who knows anything about agriculture knows about the need for fallow years. But this is over and above just the ordinary process of fallowing. Every 7 years, the land, give the country a rest. Let it recover from its labor, from the work that it has to do. And it's interesting, it says in chapter 26, if you look over your verse there to verse 34, you'll see there's a whole set of rewards stated there for obedience, and then punishments on disobedience listed. If you look down at chapter 26, verse 34, concerning the Sabbath for the land, it says, "The land will enjoy its Sabbath years all the time that it lies desolate, and you are in the country of your enemies. And then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbath. All the time that it lies desolate, the land will have its rest. It did not have during the Sabbaths you lived upon it." In other words, what's saying there is that if you don't put this into practice, if you don't give the land a break, there'll be a time when it will not sustain you any longer. I will throw you out of the land. If you will not go give it a rest, I will cast you out of the land, and I will enforce rest upon the land. I will separate you from it so that you cannot exploit it any further. And it's interesting, when you turn to the book of Jeremiah, who's prophesying the coming exile to the children of Israel, and he says the day is coming where the Lord is going to throw you out of the land. The very thing that he says to them is because you would not give the land its rest. And it seems there, do you remember how many years that the exile was going to be? 70 years. Now, if the land was to have a 1 year, that's 70, that means 70 years. That's 70 Sabbaths have not been observed. That goes back, that's the previous 700 years. If my fat maths is correct, that means over the last 700 years prior to that event, the children of Israel were not giving the land its rest. And so eventually it all piled up and piled up and piled up and said, enough, you're leaving the country for 70 years, it's going to have its holiday, it's going to have its break. If you cannot look after it, I will look after it. I will defend what is mine, what I have made, what I have loved, what I have created, that which I've entrusted to you. That's the kind of substance of it there. So it seems that people were struggling to keep the law. That's the point I'm trying to make. The Jubilee law, the Sabbath law, the people in human hands. And I think what we're reading here is that, you know, we put trust in laws. I hope you have a belief and a confidence in the rule of law, right? I hope rule of law is something that's important to you in our own society today. But the idea that law is the answer is thrown out here. Here are the greatest laws of them all, the most enlightened laws in all history. And it seems that when you put them in the hands of mortal men, sinful men, somehow we seem to find a way, don't we, to dampen and to prevent the real effect and benefits of even the very best laws. Law is not the answer. Law is good, and we need law, good laws. But the idea that if we just had good laws, oh, let's just have good laws, and everything will be all right, it seems that that is not the case. Even the best laws in the world cannot say there's a fundamental problem working out in people's lives, isn't there? There's something wrong with us. Because it's not just the scriptural record, the whole of history says that people will exploit the weak. They'll take advantage of their opportunities. They will push things because something's working in people's hearts, in people's lives. Greed gets a hold of human nature, doesn't it? It rules some part. You know, I'm saying partly these things because we're about to begin a month which leads up to the world history's largest ever materialistic festival. The greatest expenses are about to be shed in vast, vast numbers. $500 billion in America alone on Christmas. $500 billion. History has never, ever seen such levels of acquisitiveness, of materialistic acquisitiveness, the desire to have more and more and more and more and more. The scale of it is increasing all the time. And of course, if you're trying to sustain that volume of having and holding and possessing, there's people at the bottom of the pile somewhere. There's the land on which we actually stand, which has to sustain this somehow. And you've seen the photographs of parts of the world. There are parts of the world that are looking absolutely wasted, exhausted. You've seen the photographs of the rainforests in Brazil, stripped bare. You've seen the open cast mining. You've seen the pollution pouring out into the rivers. You've seen the damage, the brokenness. You've seen the people who are living in virtual slavery in parts of the world. You've seen the sweatshops. You've seen parts of the world where the average life expectancy is 30 or 40 years. You've seen people who virtually ever never see the light of day and live in smog and squalor and favelas and squats. And to sustain an economy, a way of life, an acquisitiveness, a desire for wealth. 6 days you shall labor, but the seventh there shall be rest. 6 years you'll work the earth. The seventh year, there has to be a break. There has to be a rest. There has to be some opportunity for people, for the world to somehow regather itself, recapture itself. God made it, and it is good, isn't it? God made us, and we are good. We are very good. But you can take a human being who's very good and you can push them and force them and work them, and that you can work them into the ground until they become a miserable, bitter, twisted, empty shell of a creature, barely able to reflect the image of God. And take a beautiful, verdant world and turn it into an exhausted, empty, vacuous place. Because our desire to possess and to have more is greater than our love for God. And I think these laws speak to this subject. The land. You know, you've got all these young people, haven't you? They're just rising up. They're speaking out for the... I mean, I saw a picture the other day of a little dolphin somewhere in New Zealand. There's a photograph of it jumping out of the water. And it said, have a look at this dolphin, because the laws that have been enacted by the New Zealand Parliament have insufficiently guaranteed the preservation of this species in the next 20 years. They will be extinct. Because, quite simply, their environment, their need to... So they will, those conditions will go because of the farming regulations and all the rest of it. They've been, their species pushed the brink. There are creatures going extinct all the time. Yes, every day, and I think I'm right in saying there are creatures going extinct, species going extinct around the world. And you get young people, activists and people like that, and they speak up for them. They try to be the voice for, you know, dolphins, in case you haven't noticed, cannot turn to Parliament. And, you know, they can't, it's not going to happen. The rainforests are not going to speak for themselves. It's us. It's us, isn't it? In the end, human beings who have this responsibility. Because what you find here, and in the end, because of this selfishness, because of this sort of element, you know, the only way sometimes I think to actually get us to change and to reconsider these issues is by appealing to our own natural desire for self-interest. Because if you look in chapter 26, verse 35, this thing about being thrown out of the land, if you don't look after the land, I will throw you out of it. If you won't rest there, I will force rest upon it. But basically the message there is that it's to your own destruction that you exploit human beings. It's to your own destruction that you exploit the natural resources. If you push it and push it and push it, you'll have nothing left. It's going to come back on you. And it's amazing, isn't it? You know, there was in the Middle Ages, there was a whole phase of kind of apocalyptic, you know, everybody's caught up in this apocalyptic sense that the world's about to end and stuff like that. You listen to the radio today, you listen to what on the TV, people are talking about the apocalypse today, a big environmental apocalypse, aren't they? All the time. Global warming. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not trying to say I know what's going to happen. But they're basically saying, we have never seen a typhoon like the typhoon we've seen in the Philippines the other day. Those are the fastest winds recorded in the world in the whole of our history, as far as we know. What's going on? What's going on? Are we getting to a point where something is unsustainable? Is the balance being tipped? Are we just exploiting? Do we never, ever rest? Are we so restless with our desires to live a certain kind of lifestyle? And we're trying to sustain that because that's what the person next to us is trying to sustain, and we're just watching each other. And the consequence of that is that it looks like the whole thing is just could just slide and we'll lose it all. I don't know. But I know that God is a God of order, and he's a God of who governs by law, and that his laws are inviolable. We cannot cheat God. We cannot mock God. That much I know. These people were warned, if you exploit the land, if you exploit the people, I will kick you out. Basically. And God is not mocked. He knows what's going on. Yes, the Israelites, they carried on with their Sabbath, defiling of the Sabbath year, year after year, year after year. God didn't do anything. Oh, God, he doesn't care. He's not even involved and stuff like that. And then the year came and they were out for 70 years. 70 years. So, God is not mocked. He governs by his law. And I always love that illustration. People used to give this more about preaching of the gospel and, you know, the need to respond to God. You know, he used to say, talk about, you know, when you go down the motorway and then there's those exit roads going off the motorway. And you go up and there's those little rings and then you go off into the other roads. And they were saying, you know, the gospel is calling us down this road and people always try and take these exits off. He says, but On the law of God, you go off on your little exit, but there's no other outwards. You just go over the top and you come back down again, just where you were. You cannot escape God. It's a closed system. It's a closed circuit. There is no other way. You have to reckon with God. Ultimately, we have to do it his way. He is God. And if at the end of the chapter there, in verse 53 there, you'll see those this phrase of ruthlessness. I don't know if you remember it as I was reading it to you. This passage that keeps saying, you know, don't deal with people. Don't deal with this world ruthlessly. But tell me, is there any ruthlessness around? Anybody noticed any ruthlessness? A little bit? There's a lot of ruthlessness. And what is driving that ruthlessness? What drives the big drug cartels, the drug gangs in Mexico? It's greed in the end, isn't it? Striving after power. They're willing to do anything, anything to have more, to have more. Morality just goes out the window. They'll exploit. Now, I'm not sure if I got my maths right here, but I think I've got my maths right here. okay? There are 500,000 million hectares of agricultural land in the world at the moment. There are 7 billion people. If you divide those people up into groups of, say, about 15, a couple of grandparents, their three kids, their spouses, and two or three kids apiece, a group of about 15, that group of 15, every group of 15 people in the world could have. Has anybody got their math right? Come on, you're an accountant. You better get this right, Andy. I'm picking on you again. 25 acres apiece. Yeah, here's your day off. Very good. Very good. 25 acres apiece. For every group of 15 of us. You know, if you had 25 acres for a little, you could do something, couldn't you? You could make a life for yourself, couldn't you? You could grow something. You could have some dignity. You could make it work. It may, and the things that you didn't have, you'd probably find somebody who had them, and you could swap and exchange. You could make it work, couldn't you? On paper. There's plenty here. There's plenty here. How have we got to where we've got to? How has the world got itself into the state that it's in? How come there are so many people who are so downtrodden and have really nothing, relatively nothing? How has it got to this place? What is our relationship to God? What is the human right? You only have to look around at the world and you say, we have got a fundamental problem. There's something working in human nature that is not God. It's not of God. You know, all these parcels of land that were given to the people to go back to time and time again, they were given to families. To families. Home. Family. These precious bedrock things have a bit of soil on which you and your children's children could dwell. Some place that they saw that tree that their grandpa and their great-grandpa, that tree, where they climbed when they were children. Some sense of continuity, some sense of place. Not just rootless, drifting, floating round the world. Economic migrants far from home. Wage slaves. The nuclear families. Speak to grandma once a year. A little email. Thanks for the card, grandma. What has become of us? What has become of us? And really the land is sort of, these things, it should be, God gives these things to people, not to companies or to states or monopolies, but people. And that's just not how we see the world these days, is it? And I don't, you know, prosperity seems to be measured in such perverse and odd ways. But to have a home, to have a family, to know who you are, to know who you come from, where you come from, to be able to make something or grow something or do something. Now, that seems to be prosperity as far as this image here is, that you can go back to your land, your place. Not whether you've got the latest model of such and such a mass-produced item that you kid yourself for a moment that you're special. But you know what? There's 250,000 people who've got the exactly same thing. What is prosperity? And the land that these people have been given here, it's from the Lord. It's a gift from God. They've been given something by God. It's sacred to them. It's holy to them. It's a gift. They never, you know, that's the other thing, isn't it? People have this sense of proprietary. They own. I probably haven't pronounced that right. But they own. They feel they own. I own you. I own this. This is mine. Mine. There's no sense of that in here. This belongs to God. I'm a stranger. I'm a sojourner here. I'm a tenant on God's farm. I live here by his grace and by his goodness. I'm thankful for the land that's mine, my family, for my home, for his goodness, his laws, for his ways. This doesn't belong to me. This is something I'm going to pass on. A sense of the future, a sense of hope. That's all the things that I see in this. A place where I could rest, where I can kick off my shoes at the end of the week after a full day's work, full week's work, kick off my shoes and sit down and just look at it all, watch the children play and watch the seasons pass and the different buds come out on the trees and just rejoice in God's goodness and in his love. How few people know anything of what that's like in this world today. There are 7 billion of us in this great and glorious world that God has made. And the truth is, you just see families just being torn apart. People have lost their home. People have just lost their home. Who will rescue us from this? Who will redeem us? Who will bring us back? Who will give us an inheritance? How are we going to find the way back from all of this? This is the big questions that I think this chapter churns up in its all. How are we going to treat people around us? The people who, you've got a better property, you let somebody live in your property. How do you treat them? If you see this is mine, you treat them as yours. If you realize this is just a gift from God, do you just give them the same respect and give them some rest, give them a home, give them a place? It affects the way we see everything, doesn't it? And if we don't, we just expose ourselves to all the ruthless forces, human and natural, that in the end will enforce the law. You know what happened to the reason? How did the children of Israel leave out of the land? How were they exiled from the land? Did they just get a notice order saying you've got to go now? Yes, they had plenty of those, and they ignored every single one of them, and they killed the prophets, didn't they? The ones who bore them. In the end, when Israel was taken out of the land, God raised up the Babylonians, and they were the most crude, violent, the basest forces in human nature, equipped and armed and released against them. Barbarianism, if you want. These people were given the most elevated laws to be the greatest people on earth. And if they wouldn't do it, then the most base forces were just allowed to come loose. We talked about the forces of nature. There are also human forces at work in this world that are ruthless and merciless. The people on the outside, the people who have nothing, got nothing to lose. The world is changing all the time. And I sometimes think when you look at what happened to Israel, it's like he allowed these lesser powers to serve God in punishing his people for their remorseless materialism. That in the end, he was determined to give them, they needed a spiritual life. That's the most important. If you haven't got a spiritual life, what profit is man if he gains the whole world, but you've lost your soul? And it happens. It happens. And so we're warned, aren't we, by these chapters? We're warned about this relentless drift. It's interesting as well. How did you notice? I don't know if you picked up on that. I think it's around verse 23 and verse 29. How if you sold a bit of land, you could redeem it back again. The land was really important. If you sold a bit of property in the city, though, you had 1 year, and if you didn't buy it back in a year, it would defaulted for good. It wasn't. It's as if somehow this great drift towards the cities. I don't know what the proportion is, but I think, are they saying that 2/3 of the world's population are going to be living in cities by the 2050? I've just seen some huge cities, these great sprawling cities, massive cities. Seoul just spreads for miles and miles and miles. London spreads for miles and miles and miles. Taiwan just goes on and on and on. Hong Kong, they live in skyscrapers that just seem to just scratch the sky. I mean, literally, they live up to their name. They're just people just concentrate. People are going into the cities. There are 35 million people in Tokyo now. 35 million people. And everybody's drifting in the cities. And it seems that, you know, when you've got the land, you've got the possibility of redemption. You've got a place. But once you've gone into the cities, it's so transient. It can become so impersonal. Everything passes hands. It's all commerce. And you end up, you can end up. There seems to be a warning. It's not against cities. It's not against cities. But there are warnings about this drift away from just this stuff. You know, I saw these. You know, the overwhelming majority of people who live in Hong Kong live off the ground. The overwhelming proportion of people live in the sky. They have no physical ground under their feet at all. And that which they touch is not theirs. They have nothing, not one bit of ground they can set their foot upon and say, this is mine. Not a garden, not a stamp, nothing. They live in these towers. Separated from the land. If you're totally separated from the land, the danger is you can end up, as what happened with Babel, they tried to build a tower up to heaven. It seemed the closer they went up and up and up and up and tried to up to be with the gods, in the end, they seemed to get further and further away from God. Because God gave us this land. He said, you know, here's the garden. I want you to tend it and keep it. Babel and Babylon. Always been warned, these great cities just becoming prouder and more exploitative and less concerned and acquisitive. It's a real danger, isn't it? It's a real danger of what can happen. Egypt's always been warned again and again about being ruthless, and what will happen. And Israel keeps being warned, don't grind the face of the poor. So easy to do. And in the days of the prophets, they were saying how people were just joining field to field, land to land. They were just busy extending their estates and buying up people's property and land, giving no people a chance to return to their land at all, just building their empires. It doesn't look like it'll end well. It doesn't look like it'll end well. Well, as Christians, how are we told? We're told, associate yourself with the humble. Remember the parable in James about the rich man coming into the service? And the poor man is pushed to the back. He said, well, don't sit there. No, you go and sit at the back up there. You're a bit smelly and dirty. But you've got a nice rig on. You come sit up at the front here. Is that honoring to God and his purposes and his plans? It isn't, is it? Because there's a fundamental dignity that's been given to man. The only people it seems who have any security in the city is in verse 32, the Levites, the people whose business is God. If God is your business, then you can somehow find a place in the city that's more enduring, it seems. The danger is otherwise you could just lose your inheritance out there. But if you make your stake with God, well, he can guarantee it. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being rich. You know I'm not. So I'm just saying it's got its dangers, and I'm saying it's got its responsibilities. And we have to be mindful of all these things. It's all about hope. It's all about hope. I've got so much stuff on here, as you can imagine, from this very rich passage. I'm going to have to draw a line under it, I think. But I just see here, God gives people hope. He even gives the earth a hope and a future, doesn't he? He cares about what he's made. And we just got to make sure that we're like that too, and not pushing everything to the extreme, not pushing everything to the max, not going all the way. You don't have to use on the speedo when it says 100. You don't have to use it all. 70's fine on the motorway, that sort of thing. We don't have to give 100%. Don't give 100%. Have a break. Make sure you've got some buffer for yourself. Isn't that the big thing, isn't it? You've been working up in the. I'm giving 100%. I'm giving 110%. You are going to die young. try 70 or 80%. Give properly, generously, well. Do it well. And make sure you rest. Make sure it's sustainable. I'm going to take everything out of all of this. No. Just take what you need. Just take what you need. This Christmas, enjoy Christmas. Enjoy it. I'm going to draw a line under it. I'm going to not say any more. Thank you for your attention. We're going to sing something.